Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, hello, and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton, and it's an exciting day, the very first broadcast of the show. So I want to introduce the flavor of the show first to get myself situated with this. I won't be taking any callers. However, some folks have reached out to me with questions prior to the show. You can find me on Twitter at School of Tennis. So that's one way to reach out. Let's see here. There'll be regular features designed to help you play better today. And then also we're going to work on your philosophical underpinnings to help you understand the game more. Of course, many of you know that we have a very special guest today in Dick Gould, 18-time national champion coach from Stanford University. He will share some precious words of wisdom gleaned from an extremely long career. He and I already covered the age before beauty thing before the show. Okay, what is the Infinite Tennis name all about? It means no limits, and that we're going to cover rock-solid principles of the game that stand the test of time while looking for the next step that builds the game by standing on the shoulders of giants who came before. It stands for knowing what you know and understanding that in the infinite there's always much more to know. It also asks, are we building on a foundation that lasts into eternity? Infinite Tennis questions authority while hoping to learn something great. Infinite Tennis does not kowtow to the bullies because it has bigger fish to fry. One person said to me, preach the gospel, but I think that we need to really look up the real meaning of that word. Another one called me out to say that what I plan to do today doesn't meet his needs. So I say, all right, we're going to have to dismiss that. We're going to go forward and we're going to be positive. And any kind of controversial stuff that might happen on the show is going to be after we go leave live air. So there will be some tough questions and some things that stakeholders really need to know, and that's going to happen after the 30-minute mark. All right, so our first feature is Play Better Today. Our guest is going to discuss a little bit more about what he expects of his athletes, but I hope to foreshadow this a bit. Play better is a powerful cue that helps you open up to the possibilities. I was at a tennis convention lunch in a casual conversation with Bryden Yim of University Club in Palo Alto that introduced me to this phrase, and he explained how this all works. But let's talk about what it's not. It's not the play better than an angry junior whines when he cries, I can't believe I'm playing so bad. It's not the play better I tell my doubles partner when he's making me lose. Play better simply means I'm capable of a better performance than the way I am performing right now, and I need to do better in order to have a chance to win. Repeat after me at home. I want to play better. I need to play better. I can play better. Okay, stop. Many times, my players are able to raise their game immediately when we ask them to play better now. 90% of the time they do it, and sometimes dramatically so. So go out on the court today. Try this out. If you're kind of getting in a lull with your game, stop and say to yourself, I want to play better than I did yesterday. Okay, so we're going to have a short commercial break here, And then when we come back, we're going to get into where the rubber meets the road.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, great. Welcome back. And let's examine our next topic, which is where the rubber meets the road, because there are some really key places where we interface with the game. Each of these places where the rubber meets the road. The ball is rubber. Our strings and grips are rubber. Shoes, rubber. The court is the road. In an abstract way, our eyes and minds are also an interface with the rubber and the road. So in this segment, we're going to be sharing some subtle thoughts and focus on one aspect at a time so that over a period of weeks, you're going to be able to practice these and have a stronger philosophical underpinning to how you play. All right. So we're going to talk about seeing the ball. Your eyes are your most important body part. Just as you hear about, you know, first comes the psychological difference between watching and seeing. Just as you can hear without listening, it is also possible to watch without seeing. Seeing can actually be more of a passive achievement, but with an interested attention on the ball. More practically, be sure to see the ball come out of the opponent's strings. See the arc of the ball. Follow it to the bounce. Because the court is not perfectly flat, and every ball spins differently. Seeing the bounce of the ball is among the most critical moments for you to pay attention to. When you see the ball better, you will position yourself better, hit more cleanly in the middle of your strings more often. The most important part is to be truly interested in seeing the ball rather than angrily trying to force yourself to watch the ball. I have never heard anyone say to themselves, watch the ball, while sounding calm and confident. I don't know why that is. So I say, see the ball. And now shifting gears on the balls for a moment, we're going to talk for a brief moment about the taught mandates, the 10 under tennis mandate. And after the live broadcast is over, I'm going to ask Dick Gould about the mandate and specifically about the transition balls. So I hope that you will download that so you get that part. What I don't want to do is distract away from getting to know Dick Gould. That's my most important thing for today. But we're going to talk about the quality of the tennis balls because that is a very important interface between player and the game. All right. So now we're going to go to our guest here. And Dick, are you there?
I'm here, Bill. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How could it be better in a day like this?
It's beautiful. Hey, my first question is, do you actually still play tennis?
I haven't played in 30 years, probably, other than a set or two of social mixed doubles on a tour or something.
That's perfect. You know,
it's like the doctor. You're around tennis 48 hours a day or 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, and you finally get a day away from it when your team's not playing, you're not traveling, and the last thing in the world you want to do is grab a tennis racket and go out and hit a tennis ball. So I stopped that a long time ago. I read or go for a hike or something a little bit different when I have a day off, which is not usual.
I was reflecting on that because I've seen you so for so many years, and I don't know if I've ever seen you strike a tennis ball.
So, the funny thing is, my team, probably the last 25 years I coached, never did either. And about once a year, I'd get out there. It'd be a nice day in the afternoon. And some kid would come out a little early, and I would, hey, let's hit a couple. And he kind of try to be nice to me. And oh, okay, coach. And you know, hey, that guy can hit the ball. It was always a little bit of a revelation. I think sometimes it almost dropped dead.
I can relate to that. So I know that you're now the retired coach, head coach anyway, at Stanford. What is it that you're doing right now?
Well, I stopped coaching after 38 years in 2004. And at that time, I submitted a job description with my resignation saying that I would like to continue on at Stanford, but in the role of director of tennis. A lot of what I was doing at the time was promotion of the game locally and in the area. And I wanted a little more time to spend, reach out a little further, different areas. I wanted to do things that Stanford hadn't been able to do, which I didn't have time to be able to do when I was coaching. And so created a job description and submitted it. And they said, hey, that sounds good. I think that we think that can really help us. So that's what I did. And that's what I'm doing.
Well, that's great.
I always wanted to host the NCAAs as an example, but I didn't want to host it until our facility was done. And that was always kind of the carrot for the next step of the facility building. It took us about 25 years to raise all the funds. We raised almost $20 million ourselves to build that tennis facility at Stanford.
Wow.
The Tobey Tennis Center. And that you don't do that overnight. There wasn't a penny of help from the university or from the athletic department. We did it ourselves. And that was all-encompassing. And when we finally got it done as far as we could go and got it ready to be able to help host the NCAAs, then I didn't have time to run it in the way I felt it needed to be run. So that was one of my goals when I retired from coaching, was to host the NCAA championship and make it something that had never been done before, go a step beyond, above and beyond what had been done, make it special for the players, and encourage a format that was different. We submitted a bid for the NCAAs that, for the first time, included men and women the same site. And we didn't have anyone submitted to, but the Men's Tennis Committee, which we did, and they kind of go, what's this? And so they held it in abeyance for a year, reached out to the Women's Committee. They discussed it for a year together and came back and said, hey, that's a good idea. Let's give it a try. And so it was actually the first time it was done that way, and it was here at Stanford, and it's been a resounding success, actually.
Terrific. Hey, so I guess, and to hear Mike Montgomery tell it, you could have actually applied for president of the university.
I would work for Mike any day.
You heard that one? Yeah. So let's move forward here a little bit. Now, you know, I like the standing on the shoulders of giants thing, and I would like to know about who were your mentors that you looked up to, and what were some of the things that shaped your career?
Well, you just mentioned one of them. I think Mont Montgomery was what he did, how he did it, influenced me a great deal. I think he's a tremendous human being. He's an outstanding, a great coach. Took a program, as we did in tennis, that really wasn't a significant factor and brought it up to the top, as Tara Vanderveer did in women's basketball, as Bill Walsh did in football, Tyrone Willingham and Jim Harbaugh, what David Shaw has done in football now. Mark was our baseball coach. Peyton Jordan. These guys did things special for Stanford. And you don't want to do something unless you can do it special. Tennis would be a great example of that. When I was a teaching pro and a high school coach and then later a junior college coach while I was a teaching pro, as an example, everything we did, every match we played, every tournament we ran, we had sliced oranges, which I would slice manually. And we did all through my coaching career at Stanford, on the court, on each court for every match. We had a scoreboard on each court for every match. In those days, you didn't have those little plastic flip things. We made them. And we tried to make it special for the players. And I think that's really important when you're doing something, to try to do it the very best. And I always enjoyed trying to be creative enough to do it a little bit differently and something that hadn't been done before. And I've enjoyed that part of my teaching and coaching throughout. Back to the question. I missed it. Oh, and let's talk about role models. Tennis.
Hey, Dick,
hold
on one second. I'll give you a moment to think about that mentor thing a little bit, because I want to know about the people older than you that were the people that you were looking up to above you. But we're going to take a quick break for a quick commercial. And then on the other side of that, we'll cover that.
Perfect.
All right, thanks.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, great. We're back. So Dick, what about your mentors?
Well, I'm going to go right back to that ad. Jason Haynes, we used to work together, and in fact, we worked together in a Nike tennis camp, and what a tremendous person and what a great job they do at Nike tennis camps. I want to second that advertisement you just played. I didn't want to play tennis. My dad was a farmer. I grew up on a farm in Southern California in Ventura. We took swimming lessons. They didn't have public swimming lessons then. We took private lessons at a pool on a ranch, and that ranch happened to have a tennis court, and there was a guy teaching tennis there. And my folks got it in their head some way that I was going to take a tennis lesson. I was about 11 years old, and I said, no, I'm not. I don't want to play that sport. You walk around little white shorts, and it's not very seemly to be around a farm country. And they said, well, do you want to ride your horse this summer? And I said, yeah, of course. And, well, then you better take a tennis lesson. So I did, and there were the fellow who was teaching was a guy named Harold Chaffee. His daughter, Nancy Chaffee, later Nancy Chaffee Kiner, Ralph Kiner's wife, was one of the top players, became one of the top players in the world. And what I got from him was, you don't just give a lesson. You don't just teach someone to hit the ball cleanly, to move their feet, to be balanced when they hit, to load, and so on. You teach them excitement. And he was the most dynamic person I ever felt, ever saw. Right away, hitting a tennis ball became like, in those days, Ralph Kiner watching the ball. He talked about watching the ball in your preface. He would talk about, in those days, Rocky Marciano, the world heavyweight champion. You step into the punch, into the ball, like Rocky Marciano steps into a punch. And I'm thinking, hey, you know, every ball I hit, for some reason, is now exciting to me. And I couldn't get enough of the ball. I went around hitting the ball. I went back home and on the gravel driveway, tried to hit against the garage, and that was my practice partner, and I couldn't hit enough. I actually loved it. The thrill of the ball, hitting the racket, was something that never left me. And then I went to junior high school, where I was enrolled in a beginning PE class in tennis, and one of the fellows in that class was Tom Shivington, who became a lifelong friend. We were each other's best man and each other's weddings. When I left Foothill College to come to Stanford, he left his coaching job at Mesa High School and came up and took my job at Foothill College. We became business partners and had a business on the side, a corporation on the side, where we contracted with some 25 municipalities throughout the Bay Area to run their tennis program, not just in summer, but so on. And by doing that, we'd install the program, print up the teaching manuals for distribution and lesson plans, and hire the instructors and train the instructors and literally supervise them full-time, in the summertime at least. And so we didn't go into the camp business originally. This was our way of doing something, and it was really great. We worked with great people. So many people came out of those teaching programs and became teaching pros and really good people. And I had as much fun teaching teachers, potential teachers, how to teach learning to teach tennis as I did teaching top players, or beginners for that matter. I had beginning PE classes all through my tenure at Stanford, and I loved them. And the guy in junior high school who taught that class was actually a football coach, but he really liked tennis. And so he would take the better players, and Tom and I were among the better players, start taking us to the tournaments in the spring in Southern California. So we got our first taste of competitive tennis, and that was really impressive to me, that he would take his time with no pay to do that.
Yeah.
And then I move on to high school with Tom, and at Ventura High School we had a coach who was one of the top players at USC and their great teams just after the war, Arnold Saul, S-A-U-L. And he was also our basketball coach in high school, and he was very good with fundamentals, very calm, not too excitable, but he was just a great teacher of technique. And he had a great influence on me. And lastly, The fellow that touched me a great deal was my college coach, Bob Ranker. I went to Stanford with the idea of being an attorney, a political science major, but I wasn't really enthralled with the history courses and poli-sci courses, and there was a physical education major at the time. And I was teaching in the rec department in Ventura, and I really enjoyed that in the summer times when I was 18, 19, 20 years old from college. I would go back to teach swimming, lifeguard, and teach tennis, and I really enjoyed that. And I said, well, why don't you think about becoming a teaching pro? And it never occurred to me because I thought a teaching pro had to be a great player. And I was a good college player. I got to be 3 on a good college team. Not a great college team, but a good college team. But I wasn't, you know, a touring pro like a Pancho Gonzalez or a Rod Laver. And right. I said, well, you know, am I good enough? He said, absolutely. You're solid. You have good fundamentals, good tech. You know, you certainly can. You don't have to be a touring pro to be, which there wasn't in my day growing up. You didn't have to be a touring pro, in essence, to become a good coach. And he said, in fact, you can become a school teacher and then earn some money on the side by being a teaching pro and be a teacher during the full time and have your security of teaching and your security of benefits and so on and make some money on the side as a teaching pro. And well, you can easily go on to college coaching from there. And so his suggestion that I could be that, I could do that, really got me on that career path.
So isn't it incredible that, you know, you enter into this with a little bit of self-doubt, right? And then step by step, you know, improve yourself and your career and move all the way up. And, you know, I mean, there aren't too many more influential people in NorCal tennis than you, Vic. So, I mean, that's really something. I think it's an encouragement.
Well, I would throw it around a little bit, Bill. I would say that all of us as teachers, and those of you who are, or as parents you are, as whether it's tennis or something else, just as ways of life, for example, or tennis pros and teachers, school teachers, I think, you know, we don't realize how much we can affect someone. And so many times we do it without thinking we are, without realizing we are. And I think every time as teaching pros we walk onto the court, we have a responsibility to give it our very best to, number one, excite the pupil about what we're doing, to get them excited about hitting the ball. We owe it to them to give them our very, very best every second they're on the court, whether you're working with a team or working with an individual. And that's what I got when I was learning growing up, and I think that's what really influenced me overall more than anything else.
Okay, great. So would you say that is your number one tennis principle, is that excitement thing? Or
I think that's incredibly important. I think one of my greatest moments as a tennis coach, I was working my last summer at Stanford. My coach up here got me a job teaching a little bit, helping as assistant teaching at the Menlo Circus Club. And also, I was giving some private lessons in community, and I was teaching this little gal in Woodside at a private home court, and it was the end of the summer. She came in for the last 5 weeks of the summer for a lesson a week. She must have been 6 years old. In those days, the rackets were 27 inches long. They were heavy. They were big. A 4.5 light was the smallest handle you could get. The ball was bouncing fast off the court. I was 3 feet away from her, almost dropping the ball to her, and she had beautiful technique. She had the best forehand swing I could ever see. I couldn't even think about teaching her a backhand. Maybe it's indicative of my teaching ability at the time. But I made it exciting for her. And finally, the last lesson of the summer, she connected and hit a great forehand. I mean, it was that hard for her even to hold the racket. And she wasn't really coordinated. But she hit that ball, and I got excited, and she got excited. She was jumping up and down in the court, and all of a sudden, almost in midair, she stopped. And she froze, and she looked down. There's a little puddle of water forming under her. And in fact, she got so excited she couldn't contain herself, and she saw what had happened, and she ran up the steps, through the house, out the front door, and I never saw her again. I don't even remember her name. I wish I did. I'd love to meet her again now. So if you're out there listening, fess up.
you don't want too much excitement. So this will probably be our last question before the live broadcast ends, and then, you know, 8:29, I've got to wrap it up here, but we get a lot of young people listening because you can download this on a podcast, and, you know, we have parents and they're listening and people who want to be very competitive. So what advice would you give to young people and parents and all that as they find their way through the competitive world of tennis?
Well, first of all, don't press. The world's competitive in everything we do. Life is competitive, and we can stress over things we can't control. Keep things in perspective. Don't look at too broad a picture. Think a little bit more of how I can get better, whatever it is I'm doing, soccer, a sport, tennis, whatever you do in life, a hobby. classroom, of getting a little bit better relationship, a little bit better each day. There is no rush. There is no hurry. Don't take one's youth away. Play other sports as long as you possibly can into high school, at least the start of high school. Play in your high school teams and whatever sport that might be. It's nice to be on a club team, but don't neglect your high school team where all your friends are. There's no hurry. Have fun. How often and how sad it is that I see people come off a hitting lesson series at a clinic or something like that. I don't see anyone smiling. You have to enjoy what you're doing, and we as instructors have it, and no matter what the sport or subject might be, have an obligation to see that people leave our classroom, which is a tennis court in my case, with a smile and happy, and an ambition to get a little better tomorrow.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, I know that I've heard you speak, and you were talking about having won a national championship, and then immediately going right back into worrying about next year. I'm losing a couple of players, and what are we going to do next year? And that really struck me, and then you made this transition. Can you talk about how that changed?
Well, yes, I think when I came to Stanford, I really thought we had always been the top 10 in tennis since World War II when they started keeping scores, having a national championship with team scores. But we never had, I think one year I was on the team, we were two in the country, but only because SC and UCLA had violated some rules in tennis and other sports, and we were ineligible for the national championship. But basically, our average training probably before I took the job was probably 7 in the country. Not great. Not bad, but not great. And I really felt Stanford could be better than that. And we weren't winning in Stanford in anything at that time. We were 0-10 in football my last year. It was really a downtime in Stanford sport. We won one national championship, men's golf in the 50s, one in men's swimming in the 60s. Stanford was not an athletic force nationally. And I really felt with the environment we have here, the area we are in, especially for a sport like tennis, the potential was unlimited. And so that was my goal, to prove to myself that we could win a national championship in tennis. And so I think I got so caught up in that goal that it was so frustrating to me that it took me 7 years to do that. I thought I could come in here as a brash young coach and do it overnight, but things don't happen that easy. So much is involved in building a program and funding it. And when we finally won it, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I didn't care if I ever won it before. But I think in doing this and making this a goal to my team, I would get them so uptight before a match, whether they were good enough to win that match or not, and many times we were not. At least on paper, I would get them so wound up that they couldn't hit a ball, and I couldn't do a good job coaching. I became a much better coach when I got the monkey off my back when we won the first championship, because then I could concentrate more on the process of getting better and not so much the end goal of perhaps winning a championship. After that time, I very seldom mentioned the World National Championship. I did it very, very, very choice occasions, and I picked my spots. It wasn't something that was said every day. And it was said in different ways and shown in different ways. And I was much better, my players much better, because that pressure was off of them. That's important as a parent, too, that same concept.
Yeah, that's great. And then, you know, another thing that I gleaned from you was the habit. Okay, so one thing that I gleaned from you was the habit of when the player's coming off the court, that the first question should be, did you have fun? And I went right back to my high school teams and started using that, and I just saw a completely different attitude from my players in terms of the pressure that they felt. So, all right, so we're gonna wrap this live part up here. We're gonna wrap the live part up, and I'm gonna give you a little bit of information. And those of you who want to hear kind of the insider talk, this for the stakeholders of tennis, that's coming up in the podcast, and I really would like you to download that, because Dick's going to talk about some very important stuff. You can reach me on Twitter at School of Tennis, and then also on Facebook at Patton School of Tennis, and I wish that you would. As we approach future shows, if you have an issue that you would like discussed, I'd be more than happy to take a look at that. And those things that are really pertinent to what we're doing, absolutely, we're going to get those on the show. You know, we want to really tackle the big things and keep that going and kind of let let the trivial stuff go. So thanks for coming out, Dick, and I'll see you on the other side. Stay on the phone. Here we go.
Thank you, Bill. Nice show.
All right, so but we're not done yet. Okay.
Still here.
So, because we're still recording at this time. And you're still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, good. So, you know, came up, you know, I had some interested parties, and they saw your letter in RSI Magazine in support of the mandate for the 10 and under tennis. And so, you know, could you kind of explain the extent of your support for that? I mean, do you support it in full or in part? Or, I mean, if you can just kind of outline that, that would be great.
Okay, sure. I surely will. First of all, I thought the idea of the softer balls was just a great idea when it came out, 15, 20 years ago, Wilson had Pee Wee Tennis, someone else branded a little bit differently with the lower nets and so on, but it really didn't catch on. I thought it was a great concept. I used it in some of my camps, and I thought it was great. And so when the USTA, Martin Blackman, and some others approached me from Boca and said they were asked to put in this, by the USTA to put in this in their department, the player development, to put in this this mandate to develop it, help develop it, that they asked if I would support it and what I felt about it. And I said, well, I have to know more about it. And so I got a pretty quick course on what their intention was, what to do. And I was really excited about it. I am still excited about it. I think it's a tremendous thing for tennis. Immediately, however, I mentioned to Martin, I think Patrick, I'm not sure, but I mentioned immediately when it was in its infancy, the planning of it even, that I felt something was missing, that a transition, a change is always difficult, and we have changes in our lives every day, and the measure of us is how we adapt to those changes and how we deal with them. I did agree with them. I felt that it very definitely, to get something done, you needed a mandate because we were so used to doing things a certain way, and you had to enforce that mandate. But I felt that the red ball, orange ball, green ball really was not enough, and I said so. I said, I think you really need, I'm missing something here, you really need a yellow ball category with rankings and with competitive play, but you also need the mandate. So there's got to be some way to devise a program where you can quickly, if you are a very talented 7-under, 8-under, 9-under, pass out of the transition phase, even though you probably should be required to do a couple of these things, make it as painless as possible, so those who really, really are good enough can pass out of that and then play with a regular ball in 10-under. And at that point, it was far enough along that they couldn't make that adjustment. They had to go with it. Since that time, they're starting to include that a little bit more. I believe they realize that it's not going to work quite the way it is. And I think we have to realize this whole thing is a work in progress. I think back, you asked me a question, I'm going to try to answer it, and I'm doing it with essays. You know, I've seen a lot of changes.
Yeah.
When I was in my lifetime, I think the age group cutoff has been changed by 3 months. Boy, it was great. I have an October 1st birthday. The cutoff used to be, I don't know when it was, but I was the youngest guy in my age group. And the change they were considering would have put me the oldest guy in my age group. What advantage that would be to gain 11 months or 10 months in advantage of physical strength and growth. The next one was the age group change. We used to have 18 and under, 15 and under, 13 and under, 11 and under, before it became 18, 16, 14, and 12. All the people who were hurt by that change or affected by it, the 15 and unders didn't get to be to the top of the age group for ranking purposes because all of a sudden it was 16s. You know, it hurt them. It was tough on them. That was hard. The pros, I used to have players that would play in summertime only and earn enough points in the summer to be ranked top 100 in the world. They could come back being ranked top 100 in the world in the pro tennis in 3 months of play, 4 months of play, and leave college after that next year playing in college as an amateur while they're ranked the top 100 as a pro, and come back in the fall and go into Wimbledon right after graduation. So my points left to go right into Wimbledon, the main draw. And then we started, so, I don't know, it's been changed once or twice, but it was a best of 14 or a best of 18, which protects the players that are there already. And it makes it harder and longer for a young guy to go up. It takes you a year and a half or two years now to get up to where you used to be able to, what you used to be able to do in 3 months. So change is inevitable, and it's always hard on someone. And I feel for these young kids who are caught up in this. You don't want them to have to go back if they're really, if they're truly talented in what they're doing. But someone in all these changes has been affected a little bit. I think our job as a profession and USJ's job as our governing body is to make this as seamless as possible and to have as little negative impact on these kids as we possibly can. I think all the criteria for why, all the reasons for why they've done this and incorporated this are incredible. I think it's going to have a dramatically strong effect on tennis before this thing is over, but it's going to take the transition years of probably a couple of years for this thing to really take hold. And it's not going to have any chance of taking hold unless it's mandated. I think that anytime there's change, it's easy to criticize. And I think that it's much better to be positive, to offer suggestions. And I would suggest to anybody, and I have a lot of good friends on the other side of the fence on this thing, and a lot of people who are, they like part of it and don't like the other part of it. And my suggestion is, instead of tearing it down and being vindictive about it, maybe we ought to think about a little bit about getting guys together and coming up with a pathway that might be a little different than that which proposed now, but might work better for these kids in transition. I think overall this plan, I'm really in favor of it, but in transition. When you mentioned the type of ball, my eyes started rolling. I didn't realize that, I must admit. But on the other hand, we had, when I was growing up, there were tournaments in Switzerland in pros using tree-torn balls with no air. There were other tournaments using extra duty, some using regular. You know, so the balls are different no matter what we do, and you have to deal with that a little bit. And I frankly don't think that's such a big factor, but I can't say that for a fact because I'm not out there working the trenches every day with it. I don't think that's a major. I don't think that that can be addressed. I don't think that's the major problem. I think that's an excuse maybe for attacking this whole concept. I don't think that's that can be changed, and it will be changed over time, but I don't think that's a problem right now we should be addressing.
I really have to honestly disagree with you because my experience with the balls is that I've tried out probably 7 or 8 different brands of balls. And among the red balls, I can tell you that there are at least 2 brands that are just nearly worthless. And I've tossed a red ball from one particular brand of, you know, to a 5-year-old kid, and then the kid gives me the stink eye, like, hey, coach, aren't these balls supposed to make it easier? You know, so I know of 2 brands where the balls, one ball just doesn't bounce at all, and the other ball bounces so unpredictably that the kid can't really make contact, and that's self-defeating. And then another brand that I like, the ball actually is plays so much better when it's cold, but it's way too lively when it's hot. So.
Well, that's good. My only experience with it, frankly, is every year in my camp, and that's my only experience with it. I haven't experienced those problems, but this is an easy thing, Bill. This is an easy thing to get people together on and to fix. This is not what we should be talking about. We're talking about 10-under tennis. It is. It's something it's indicative of a lot of these things. It's something we can fix if we get together on it. It's not. This is a minor thing. It's major. You're right in a way, but this is fixable. It's like standardization of balls and internationally and for competitive play for the pros. This is an easy thing to fix, and it's new to me, and I appreciate what you're saying, and I can't argue that. I certainly have to agree with you. I don't know any better than that. But this is not a difficult thing to fix. That should be a factor in what we bring forth in a positive way as teaching pros who are dealing with this and dealing with our pupils going through this transition as a group to the governing bodies, whoever they are, Northern California, whoever, and we should lobby for this, and we will be successful if this is in fact a fact, which I'm sure it is. But we should do it. We should do it. We should not do it as a mean. Use this as a means to tear down 10-under tennis. This is easily fixable.
Right. Well, you know, the other thing is the extreme variation of developmental levels of children. Up to the age of grade 2, and I know this as a parent, you know, that some parents despair that their first grader is behind or whatnot. And, you know, we had a child who had a certain, developmental issue, that worried us greatly. And, you know, we were reassured, oh, don't worry, they all catch up by the end of grade two. And sure enough, they did. So, but when you take this very wide range of 5 to 8-year-olds, and some of them are extremely savvy and have great hand-eye coordination, and others have virtually none, and you're channeling them through such a narrow channel, then some, because of their great talent, are going to become bored, and others, because of their latent developmental abilities, could be stigmatized by, oh, I had to play red ball until I was 8.
So, Bill, I totally agree with you, and I think that's something that this pathway. In fact, my first thought when I saw the standards for red ball, yellow ball, red ball, orange ball, and green ball were that there was no pathway. And since they mandated this finally as a second course of action, they come up with a pathway. The pathway is not perfect. The pathway is going to evolve. And what the point you bring up, I think, is very valid. And this is a kind of thing that were you as a leader in the field, and other people like you are dealing with this every day, have to get together and not criticize the system, but come up with in a positive way with a suggestion on how, with an alternative, how do we keep the integrity of starting with a softer and larger ball, progressing upward to a smaller and bigger court, from a smaller court to a bigger court, bigger ball to a smaller ball. How do we keep the integrity of this concept, which I think is sound? I think most of us do feel that, to a point. And how do we define when someone is ready to move on? And let's take that pathway that I think is not a bad pathway, but may be a little too general and too all-encompassing. Let's take that pathway. Let's see how it works, first of all, for a year. Don't give up on it right now. Let's see how it works for a year. And then Let's, in the meantime, let's look at it and develop a way in our minds as a group of professionals who are out there every day in the trenches that we see, who are working with it every day, and develop a positive pathway with let's take it and tweak it a little bit so it fits the kids better. We can do that. But we can't do this by being vindicative and saying this is bad, this won't work, this whole thing's, you know, let's give it a try, see how it works. We're doing that now. It's going to go this summer. We can't do anything about that right now. But as it goes, let's make notes. Let's write down what's working, what's not working, and come up in the fall, come up with a really good, positive plan that will tweak it enough to make it that it better. And we'll do it again next year and next year. College tennis is, didn't change for centuries. And it's changed a lot over the years. It's getting tweaked consistently. And, you know, and I think it's easy to criticize, but, you know, you have to try some things sometimes. And rather than sit back and say, this is terrible, let's work together and see how we can come up with a plan that we can present as a unified group that might make the overall system a little bit better. And I think it can be done. I think in 2 or 3 years, this is going to be a phenomenal program. Right now, okay. it's a work in progress.
So you would say to the people developing the mandate that they also ought to really listen to all the input from pros and from parents, as long as everybody presents themselves professionally.
Absolutely, but on the other hand, they have to start somewhere, and you can't.
Right.
You know, we've just got it started a little bit this spring. The kids that I see now are the EPAT kids. These Power Tennis and Tutoring. They had a little match yesterday with the Stanford Faculty Club, and it was so much fun to see these kids out there able to play and keep rallies going where they couldn't do that otherwise, the majority of them. Okay, so it started, and it'll be in full blast this summer. Let's sit. We can't do anything about it this now. It's nothing going to change in the next 3 months. Let's see what happens that summer. Let's make notes. Let's watch it. Let's give it a chance, but let's be positive in our approach to it and see how we would suggest as a group, be sure we're unified because there'll still be different opinions, unified enough to make a presentation that will be positive in its suggestions to whatever the governing body is. Like Northern California section is going more quickly on this than other sections, as an example. Well, we can do a lot to help the rest of the country if we ourselves take the responsibility, not just to criticize it, but to accept the fact it's here for the summer and do our best to look at it objectively and look at it in terms of our players and who we're working with every day and seeing how we can tweak it so it can make it better for the kids going, realizing that in this transition there are, as it was with the age group changes and the pros going from to best of 18 or best of 14, someone's going to be hurt initially a little bit. But overall, right. I doubt they're going to be losing any ground overall.
We're out of time.
That was fast.
It was. Hey,
you got an essay when you asked me a question. But you wanted my opinion, so there it is.
No, and I really appreciate it, and I agree with much of what you say. I think I've mirrored
it. We don't have to agree on everything. In fact, there won't be any progress if we agree on everything, right?
Right, exactly. So,
and you, but you have to exchange ideas in a positive way. You can't shut people out.
Exactly, exactly.
I think people are feeling shut out a little bit, but you have to start somewhere. Let's give it a chance, keep working on it, and we'll all be better downstream.
Terrific. Have a great day.
Bill, thank you much. Enjoy being with you.
Take care. All right, everybody. So that was Dick, and what a terrific guy. I have to say that I selected him because I knew that he would be such a fun guy to talk to and easy to talk to. And so now we're done. Please download the podcast. Well, if you're hearing this, you already did. And that's it for today. So play better today and find the place where the rubber meets the road. And I hope you got something great from Dick right there.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.